Gathering Service.
Thanks again to WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, for letting us air these interviews on CKUT 90.3 FM here in Montreal. You can contact me, Robin Fadden, at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca or on Facebook at ckut-inthemotherhood. If you have any ideas for future shows, would like to get in touch, simply have something to say. Thanks for listening to CKUT.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades all, to Amandla Radio here at CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We're back again with news and analysis and briefings from the continent of Africa. And Gwen, we've quite a lineup tonight. It's looking really smart.
Yes, a lot of very nice original radio material tonight for our listeners. So we're going to kick off with an interview that I did with Catherine Cummins, who is with Mining Watch Canada. And we're back to a same old story, which is the activities of Canadian gold mining company Barrick Gold in North Mara in Tanzania. This is a long, old, and very difficult story. Barrick regularly recycles and rebrands itself and tries to leave a very checkered environmental and human rights story behind it. But Catherine is just back from a fact-finding mission in Tanzania, and what she found, sadly, is more of the same with Barrick. And it's very, very difficult relationship with local communities, to put it mildly. It is one of violence and dispossession. So she and I take a good long look at that. We're going to start with that tonight, but then we're going to follow up with a piece that Sama did. So we're just in the wrap-up of the COP27 meeting in Egypt, and Sama decided to take a look at Egypt as the host country, Egypt and its environmental and human rights record, in conversation with Montreal activist Ihab Lutayif. Very interesting conversation on how Egypt really tried to kind of polish its reputation by hosting this conference, thought it would get away with some good brownie points, but in fact, Ihab argues that it shone the spotlight on its terrible human rights record and environmental record. So that's the conversation they're having in the second half of the show. Hope you enjoy it. Stay tuned. Barrick Gold has a long and very checkered past in Tanzania, including in North Mara. Dogged by a history of human and environmental rights abuses, Barrick periodically rebrands itself, but then adopts a business-as-usual approach. In 2019, Barrick Gold took over ownership of the North Mara mine. Has this ushered in a new era? Not according to Mining Watch Canada, which recently released the report, "He Was Murdered, Violence Against Kuria High After Barrick Takeover of Mine," researched and written by research coordinator Catherine Cummins, who joins us now via video conference. Catherine, welcome back to Amandla. It's been a while.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So could you just start by giving us a brief introduction to the key players in this story? So namely, the communities who are being impacted by the mine on the one hand and Barrick Gold Corporation on the other.
Yeah, so the mine is the North Mara Gold Mine. It's in the North Mara region of Tanzania, which is northern Tanzania, close to the Kenyan border. The communities around the mine are Kuria indigenous peoples, who are agricultural people, but also cattle herders. And because the gold in that area is very close to the surface in places, they also had part of their livelihood come from actually panning or searching for gold that was close to the surface. So those were the main sources of income for the Kuria for generations.
Okay.
Of course, now the mine comes along and moved people off their land. And that's where problems started, because people were squeezed into smaller and smaller areas where they didn't have enough land for their agriculture, didn't have enough land for their cattle herding, had been moved off some of the areas where they were getting gold. And so one of the consequences of all of that was that people started actually looking for gold in the waste flows around the mine. So
yeah,
this mine, sorry, do you
no,
want
no,
to?
and we're definitely going to take a good look at that as the conversation progresses. But for those of our listeners who are not that familiar with this whole story, just to sort of set up the players. So that's the community. Do you have an idea of sort of the number of people we're talking about, the population in that area that would be affected by what's going on here?
I don't have a number, but it is a densely populated area. There are seven main villages and then many, many hamlets. And the people are now living right up chock-a-block to, or cheek by jowl, I guess is the word, to the mine, to the pits, and also to the waste dumps around the pit and the huge tailings impoundment.
Okay. So talk to us a little bit about Barrick Gold. In your report, you mentioned several times that they have rebranded themselves, that they have a long history in this area. So can you just kind of walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah. So Barrick took over this mine from another Canadian mining company, Placer Dome, a good number of years ago. And initially, the mine was being run through an entity called African Barrick Gold. And so this was a subsidiary of Barrick, but Barrick always had a majority ownership in the subsidiary. So it was African Barrick Gold. Then African Barrick Gold rebranded itself as Acacia Mining. And then more recently, in September of 2019, Barrick decided to buy out the minority shareholders in Acacia Mining and run the mine directly through Barrick.
Okay, but there is some level of Tanzanian government ownership, I believe,
yes,
in the current situation, a minority.
Minority,
shareholder.
It's 16% ownership,
okay,
is the Tanzanian government, which is also a new thing. So when Barrick decided to restructure, buy out the minority shareholders so that Barrick would become the majority shareholder and also directly not run the mine, not no longer through a subsidiary, at the same time, the Tanzanian government was offered 16% ownership in the mine.
Okay. All right. So your report opens with a description of the mine security arrangement, which is a kind of a complicated and layered affair of private and state security forces. Before we take a look at their conduct, which we're going to do in some detail, could you just start by explaining who is providing security at the mine and who do they answer to? What's the chain of command there?
Yeah. So as long as we as Mining Watch have been going to the mine yearly to investigate the human rights abuses there, there have been two types of security at the mine. One type has been private security, which is hired directly by the company. And the other type has been police, Tanzanian police, who have been contracted to provide security at the mine through a memorandum of understanding between the mine, the North Mara Gold Mine, and the Tanzanian police. And so there've always been this private component and this public component, because these are public police forces, but paid by the mine, provided supplies that they need by the mine, and in a contractual agreement through a memorandum of understanding.
That's a little confusing. So does that mean that, under this memorandum of understanding, in the time that they are being paid by the mining company, they are at that point not state employees, or are they still Tanzanian police?
Yeah, this is the blurriness, right? This is a blurriness that's very dangerous. The company will argue that they are, their chain of command is still through the police, but they clearly are working to guard the mine. That's their function. And there are rules that they're following that are rules provided to them by the company. They're also being paid by the company. They're being supplied by the company. So there is this blurriness. And, just so that your listeners are aware, we are finding that this is a problem not just here, but at different Barrick mines, but also different Canadian mining companies that are doing the same thing.
Mm. Okay. All right. And we will see, I guess, how complicated this is as we now just take a look at that the relationship between these two layers of security forces and the relationship with the locals. So we know that there's a long history of abuse and violence that's been meted out by these forces on the local community. Mining Watch Canada, among others, has really documented this. Now, under this new dispensation, 2019 on, under Barrick Gold owning the mine, have you seen any improvement in that relationship or any change in that relationship between the security forces and local communities?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. One of the things that changed in the security arrangements is whereas the private security in the past had also been armed, not always with lethal weapons, but sometimes with sublethal weapons. In this case, when Barrick took over and the Tanzanian government also became involved, the private security that was brought in is an organization called Nguvu Moja, which are made up of paramilitaries, ex-military, ex-police that have been formed specifically to provide security at mine sites. So these were brought in, and initially, from the interviews we did, initially they were armed, but apparently within a short amount of time, we understand around 3 months in, they were completely disarmed. Hmm. So that now they are not armed.
Whose decision was that? Do you know?
Well, apparently that was a decision by Barrick and the mine. Again, from the interviews we did, in the time that they were armed, they were quite lethal. And perhaps it's the complaints that people brought forward. I don't know this. I can't speak to this with any, you know, definitive authority, but we do know that they were disarmed. However, the relationship with the police is still there. And the section of the Tanzanian police that are providing security services to the mine are what are known as field force units. So this is a particular part of the Tanzanian police that normally gets involved in quite violent situations. Like they may get involved with drug wars going on or security of borders, this sort of thing. So not the everyday police that are on the streets, but a particular subsection of the police that are involved in critical situations.
Okay, but I gather from your report that despite the disarming of one arm of the security forces and then the continuity of another, it does not look like the relationship between the mining company and the community is improved. Can you describe to, the report goes into great detail about the ongoing level of violence and intimidation. So could you describe that for our listeners?
Yeah, that was what was very disturbing in the visit that we did and the interviews that we did. That, okay, the Nguvu Moja, this private force, is disarmed, but the relationship with the Tanzanian police through these field force units has continued just as before. And the levels of violence at the mine are still extremely high. We interviewed, so many people that told us about different cases, and we interviewed people who had been victims or whose family members had been victims of violence. And it's clear that the levels of violence have not gone down.
Can you tell us some of their stories the people you talk to? What form is this taking and why? What's going on?
Yeah, so let's back up a little bit and talk about the why. Going back to what I initially said about the Kuria people who lived there before the mine came in, they were herders of cattle, and they were farmers, and also had small-scale mining going on because of the gold that's near the surface. Now they're moved off their land to make way for these huge pits, to make way for the tailings impoundment, to make way for massive waste rock dumps that are all over the place. So they've lost a lot of land. They've also lost their livelihood. But what they've discovered is that there's enough gold left over in the waste rock from the mine that they can go into the waste rock dumps and actually find the gold that's in that waste rock. But when they do that, when they go into these waste rock dumps, and this is men, women, and children, there's whole families going into these waste rock dumps traditionally. When they do, they're officially trespassing. So they officially become subject to excess use of force by mine security. Now, traditionally, these waste rock dumps, you know, pre the Barrick takeover in September, were completely open. Anyone could walk in. They have now been walled off. So to get into these waste rock dumps, people have to actually go over walls. So it's now primarily men and young boys that are still doing this. But once they're there, they can be shot, they can be beaten, they can be chased. And in fact, they're somewhat trapped because they're now behind these really high walls, which are also electrified. I should mention that it wasn't just the waste rock dumps, especially women and children would go into the waste rock dumps as well as men and boys. But some men would also go further and would try to go into the actual pit to find ore, you know, gold-bearing rocks. And they also, of course, were subject to actions by the police. Unfortunately, though, those actions are also often excessive. So again, this trip, you know, some of the most disturbing stories are the ones where people are shot from behind. So they're trying to leave, they're trying to flee either the waste rock dumps or the pit area, and they're shot from behind. So there's violence that happens both in the mine's property, but also in the villages. And this has also been a very long story where we've interviewed so many people over the years where they're just walking on a public road, but the mine is doing an exercise against what they call the intruders, and they're chasing them, and they chase them past the mine property, into the villages, into the public roads, with bullets flying, and people get shot. So on the report this time, we featured the casket and the funeral of one such person, and this was just March of this year. So the allegation is there again that the police were chasing someone out of the mine area, but didn't stop at the edge of the mine area, continued to chase the person through a village where people were standing around and they were shooting, and this person got shot. So this is not new. This has always happened, but unfortunately it hasn't stopped. It's obviously still happening.
You mentioned one case also of a family where the encroachment has become so bad that they literally cannot access their farm without, quote unquote, trespassing mine property to be able to get to there. Can you just elaborate a little bit on their story, because it's almost reaches the level of the absurd?
Yeah, no, it really does. This is a small hamlet that has now been surrounded by land that the mine has bought up, so has become mine land on three sides. And the roads to get into this hamlet, you have to cross the mine land. And so there's guards there. And so, you know, people from this village just going in and out of their village to go to other villages or to go to their businesses, their you know, or their agricultural land, whatever it is that they have to do, have to cross this land that is now owned by the mine, and therefore have to subject themselves to the guards. And as one person that we interviewed explained, you know, these encounters are very often very violent. The guards can rather arbitrarily decide to beat someone up, to arrest them, to arbitrarily detain them. And the one person we interviewed, this had happened to him numerous times, and he had an obvious solution. He said, why doesn't the company just give us a pass? So we could show the pass and it says, look, we live here, you know, don't beat us up, don't detain us, don't throw us in jail. We need to pass here because this is the only way we can get to our house. So yeah, that's just another one of the many, many absurdities that we just, you know, we talked about this time while we were on the ground.
It strikes me that another absurdity in this whole story is, you know, the waste rock is such a huge flashpoint and the source of so much conflict, and it's waste rock. Why, what is the problem with locals mining the gold out of waste rock? Why the opposite? Why not let them do it?
Yeah, I know that really is a head scratcher. And we've raised this with Barrick, and we're not getting a proper answer to this, other than, you know, I've met with the mine management, not this trip, but past trips, and raise this, and they say, well, it's dangerous. People shouldn't be in there. They could get hurt. Well, you know, they're getting hurt, but they're getting hurt by, you know, excess use of force by the security that are there. And, you know, the absurdity is now taken an extra step because these waste rock dumps used to be completely open. I could walk in, anyone could walk in. Now they're walling them off. So they're spending a lot of money to actually put these huge, very high, and in some cases electrified walls around the waste rock dumps. So now even just to get into the waste rock dumps, people have to cross these walls. And of course, once they're on the other side, if the police do an action to move people out and they start shooting, either, you know, whether they're shooting rubber bullets or live ammunition, people are getting caught by this
wall. Yeah, they're corralled. They're essentially corralled.
They're essentially corralled, yeah. No, it doesn't make any sense other than, you know, the only argument we've ever heard from the company is that it's not a safe place for people to be, but it's mainly not safe because of the actions of the security forces.
Now, here's a situation where, you know, it would seem that if, for instance, as just a villager who it gets caught in the crossfire or something like that, some kind of violation like that, normally one would turn to the police to lodge a report. So just earlier, you talked about how compromised the position of the police is now. So is there a police force that a local civilian can turn to if they've been shot at by the police forces working for the mine?
Yeah, this is a really big problem. It's been a problem for a very long time. So in Tanzania, if you've been harmed, assaulted by another individual, whether it's just another citizen or police, and you want medical care, you need medical care, and potentially there's going to be legal action, you have to go to the police to get something called a PF3. So this is a particular form that the police fill out to say, yes, this person's come to see me, they have these injuries, they need medical care. And then these PF3s describe the injuries, and sometimes these do end up in court. It was already getting problematic before the takeover of Barrick in September of 2019, because the police were telling us, well, when we fill them out, if it's a gunshot wound, we just say that they have a penetration wound. Mm. So they weren't wanting to be clear that it was a gunshot wound. Mm-hmm. What people were telling us now is that because, and this is primarily because of the 16% ownership that the government of Tanzania now has. So the government of Tanzania is now saying, hey, this is our mine. We support this mine. We're getting benefits from this mine. Those civil organizations like police that would normally be somewhat supportive of the people or maybe supportive of the people are now not even wanting to give them a PF3 because the policeman has to sign the PF3 and they're not even wanting to be seen as recognizing that someone has come to them who has said that they're harmed by the security of the mine. Just so that your listeners understand, the relationship between the mine and Barrick subsidiary Acacia and the Tanzanian government had been very contentious for many, many years. So there was that distance between the government and government agencies, including police, but also district commissioners and others, and the company and the mine. Now, because the government has been given 16% and the government shows up around the mine and says, you know, we support this mine, this is our partner. What people were telling us is we don't know where to go anymore.
Yeah.
Because our elected officials, our village leaders, our hamlet leaders are afraid to support us when we've been harmed by the company because they say, but the government owns this mine.
Well, would it be fair to say that it's almost like the company has co-opted the state?
Well, you know, I think that's what it looks like on the ground, right? Like the government, the company now absolutely refers to this relationship all the time. For example, when Mark Bristow goes to North Mara,
and he's the CEO, I think, of
he's
Barrick.
The CEO of Barrick, and he was there again recently. He always refers in his presentations to the villagers. He always refers to the fact that he's working with the government. The government is supporting this mine. So that message is being hammered home. And it's certainly what we heard in our meetings with people, where interviews where people said, you know, we can't go to the village chairman anymore because now they all have to support the mine.
I don't want to, I really want to move on. There's a lot more to talk about, but maybe just as a final question on this, is this a particularity of Barrick Gold, this kind of MO, and or, you know, is this kind of standard that most mining companies in Tanzania and Africa operate this way? And, you know, this is just the dirty business of mining in Africa.
Well, there's definitely a wider problem of militarization of mine sites. Mine sites are conflict zones very often because of the fact that they have come into an area and have caused, you know, hardship for the people who are living in that area. They've either contaminated water, they've removed land, they've forcibly evicted people. So there is already a situation of conflict. And often the way these mines respond to conflict is by arming themselves. So becoming, you know, little fortresses with you know, almost private armies, essentially, around them. And that is not uncommon. Barrick certainly has this problem in other places. So the other place where I work is in Papua New Guinea, and there, very similar situation. There, they also have a memorandum of understanding with the police of Papua New Guinea. The most brutal aspects of those police forces are the ones that come and they're housed by the mine, they're fed by the mine, they're paid by the mine, and they also have been accused of very high levels of violence against men, women, and children in Papua New Guinea. So this is not an uncommon situation. In Papua New Guinea, Barrick has just run out of its, in 2019, its lease was up, its first initial lease was up. Because of all of the human rights and environmental impacts at that mine, the government of Papua New Guinea initially said, you're not going to get a renewal. We don't really want you to continue mining here. Barrick sued the government of Papua New Guinea in an international tribunal, as well as in the courts in Papua New Guinea. The Papua New Guinea government was forced to back down, made these lawsuits, these legal threats by the company, very public in terms of as its reasons for backing down. And at the same time, Barrick offered the government a higher stake in the mine. So this is a modus operandi, yes, definitely.
Okay. So the second part of your report looks at the displacement of the local community to allow for Barrick's expansion of the mine. And I have to say, Catherine, I was very surprised and dismayed to learn that there's actually an acronym for this phenomenon, MIDR, Mining Induced Displacement and Resettlement. Which I guess speaks to just how many people across the globe are experiencing this phenomenon. But certainly in North Mara right now, this is going on. And again, you ask the question, has Barrick improved its practices when dealing with communities in the context of expansion that requires their displacement? One of the things that really stood out for me in the report was the whole property assessment process and these valuation forms. So can you describe this process to you, to our listeners, and maybe just give us a few concrete examples of that whole exercise?
Yeah, so there is an area, a village called Komarira, which is very close to three of the pits. And now the company wants to actually expand that mining area into this area where these people live and have lands and have agricultural plots. There isn't going to be much that they can do about that. The government has said, yep, we approve this expansion of the mine and you people have to leave. And so that's not that different than, you know, when people have to leave to make way for a road or anything else. But the, you know, once again, the way in which this is being done is so much more brutal and violent than it needs to be. And that's inexplicable, really. You know, so what's happening is these assessors are coming in. Often people don't know that they're coming or when they're coming. They come with police forces with them. People are being told, we're going to do this assessment. We're going to decide what the value is of your land and the value of the crops and the trees and the houses, structures that are on your land. Excuse me. And then you will get a check. And of course, when people say, well, wait a minute, we don't understand. We didn't know you were coming. Sometimes they're not even there when they show up. The response
they
is,
show up with police, I gather.
They show up with police. And if people just start to protest, just to say, you know, like, let's say the assessment's going on. We heard numerous cases where the assessment was going on and there's two assessors and one shouts out, you know, what he's looking at and the other one writes it down on this form. And so the one will say, well, I'm just not going to count that house because, you know, we didn't see it from the air. So we're not going to count that house. So if the person protests and says, but that's my house. I live there. My family lives there. Then what we found in our interviews was that the response was often very swift and very violent. The police were basically told to take that person on. And sometimes people were detained and arrested and even held for long periods of time. The other thing, even if people don't confront the assessors and the form is filled out, they're then asked to sign the form. So once it's been filled out, they're asked to sign it. And each of the different things on their land are given a value. So for example, if it's a mango tree and the mango tree is flowering and it's producing fruit, then it should have a certain value as a mature tree that's producing fruit. But often the values were being put very low. So let's say only 25% instead of say 75 or 80% for the value of that kind of tree. But if people were afraid and they just thought, well, I better just sign, they would sign. But then what was happening was after they had signed, the values were being put down. So the values were actually changed. So, you know, they showed us these forms where you could see something that was 25% was put down to 15%. They were also being told that anything that's valued at 15%, you don't get any payment. And there were whole properties where we saw the forms, everything was 15%. So they wouldn't get any payments. But even that does not seem to be in accordance with Tanzania law, because we've looked into what Tanzania law says. And Tanzania law says, well, even something that's 10% or 5% should be paid out. So there is no, this arbitrary rule that people are being told that if it's 15%, they're not going to get anything, also doesn't seem to be right.
And is this a BARIC process or a government process? Who's responsible for this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it is a government process. But the checks, so one of the things people have to do is hold a sign in front of them as they stand in front of their property, and it has the number of their particular case. And there it's on the sign, it says the North Mara Gold Mine. So the recipient of this or the beneficiary of this process is the North Mara Gold Mine. The checks that people are receiving, which we've been given copies of, are also coming from the North Mara Gold Mine. The people have also been complaining to the mine because the lead of this process, who has been described to us as a very brutal personality, they often find hanging out at the offices in the mine. So they'll go to the grievance office of the mine to complain about what's going on, and they'll find him there. So there's a lot of, again, this blurring of the lines. The payments are coming from the company. Mark Bristow, the CEO of Barrick, also early last year, while this process started, so the process started in 2021 and now they're in phase two, came, met with villagers and said, we're going to do this right, you're going to get good payments. So he is directly, personally addressing these relocations, these forced evictions. In the terminology, if someone is forced to be evicted for a project going ahead and it's not something they want, it's called a forced eviction. That's the terminology. But even a forced eviction doesn't have to be brutal, doesn't have to be violent, doesn't have to be intimidating. And we found all of these things to be true. Now, really important in this case is that it's not just our findings, but some of the people actually got themselves a lawyer. So 32 of these villagers actually got a lawyer from Dar es Salaam. They're paying a lot of money for this lawyer per family, and most families would not be able to afford this, but they got a restraining order. So they went before a judge and explained what was going on. And the judge said, yeah, there's enough reason to be concerned about what the evidence has been provided to me. And based on that evidence, I'm going to issue a restraining order, because if the bulldozers are allowed to go and bulldoze the land, then the evidence will be lost. So the restraining order is now in place for those 32. But really, you know, what we've said to Barrick is there's enough reason to say that you really should extend this restraining order to all people until this process has been thoroughly investigated.
Barrick's response?
So I wrote a letter to Barrick. It's a 4-page letter. It's on Mining Watch's website. No response to date, but I have now sent it also to the Business and Human Rights website, and they are following up. So hopefully we will get a response.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Catherine, we're rapidly running out of time. I had so many other questions. I guess really you've talked about that some people have resisted through the legal means, through, you know, just fighting back and saying, no, I refuse to sign these assessments of my property, that there's, you know, multiple levels of ways that people are pushing back. Barrick is a Canadian company. What's the Canadian government's position on this? For our listeners, can Canada step in? Can we as Canadians step in? There is a company that is clearly violating human rights halfway across the world.
Yeah, so I have been to see the embassy on all of this. And in fact, in that letter that I just mentioned that I wrote to Barrick about these brutal forced evictions, I also copied the embassy. No response. And when we met with the embassy and talked about the human rights abuses that have been going on for such a long time, no response. In fact, we have an access to information documents that show that the embassy refer to an earlier report of ours and say that they talked to the company and the company said, no, it's just forget it. It's not relevant. You know, Global Affairs Canada is not reaching out to us. The embassy is not reaching out to us and saying, hey, this is very concerning. We want to hear more. Come and talk to us. No, none of that is happening. What does need to happen is Canada needs to implement what we call mandatory human rights due diligence legislation. Canada needs to legislate that all Canadian multinationals operating overseas have to do due diligence on the human rights impacts and environmental impacts of their operations and report on those every year. And why that's really important is it will force companies to actually report on the kinds of concerns that we're raising. But also, if people are harmed by a company like these people in Tanzania, it will provide them a cause of action to actually bring their complaint to Canada and get before the courts in Canada to seek remedy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really important. There is a bill, a private member's bill that's been tabled, Bill 262, C-262, tabled by Peter Julian, that would create this kind of mandatory human rights due diligence legislation.
Okay, Catherine Koumans, thank you so much for joining us. I will direct our listeners to your site so that they can take a look at that documentation. This story is far from over, so we'll definitely be having it again, I would imagine, down the road, unfortunately. Thanks again so much for joining us.
And thanks so much, Gwen, for staying on this. You're right, this story is not over, and there will be more information to come, for sure.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Amandla Radio here at CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. You have been listening to the Mining Watch report on the atrocities that are being committed by Canadian mining industry in Africa. And now we're going to move to Egypt.
And stay tuned now for Sama's interview with Ihab Lutayef, who is a Montreal-based Egyptian activist, and their discussion on Egypt's hosting of COP27. And it's very in the context of a very problematic human rights and environmental record.
At the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Sharm el Sheikh, Egypt, known as COP27, leaders from around the world are gathering to discuss solutions to climate change and global warming from November 6 to 18. Many of the heads of state and governments gathered in Egypt for the first days of the UN COP27 climate summit, where reportedly 45,000 people from about 200 countries are halfway through their 2 weeks of talks on the climate crisis. COP27 is bringing governments together to accelerate global efforts to confront the climate crisis. It is an important meeting because the latest science shows that climate change is moving much faster than we are, pushing ecosystems and communities to their limits. The topics include cutting greenhouse gas emissions to meet 1.5 centigrade target and how to help countries to adapt to the impacts of extreme weather, for instance, by restoring mangrove swamps and coral reefs, building seawalls, regrowing forests, or installing early warning systems. Under the title, quote, Together for Implementation, end of quote, COP27 is hailed as the perfect opportunity to give cities and regions the recognition they deserve as key players in the fight against global warming. This implies the participation of all people in the process, which isn't, unfortunately, the case under the regime of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Swedish campaigner Greta Thunberg has skipped the Sharm el-Sheikh meeting, calling it a forum for greenwashing, citing the lack of respect for human rights in Egypt, as well as the presence of oil and gas delegates. Activists from developing countries say they agree with Thunberg that COP27 is compromised, but they say their work has an impact here, meaning Sharm el-Sheikh. So, do we also have in Canada? To talk specifically about the support of Canada for the need of protecting human rights as part of environmental rights, we talk to Ihab Lotayef, well-known activist in Montreal. Ihab, welcome to our show and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
As Greta says, human rights are part of environmental rights. Your comments?
Absolutely. Human rights are the core. Environmental rights, in my opinion, are a subset of human rights because if the environment continues going the direction it's going, we will not be able to basically live so many people their basic life needs, which many of them don't have it right now under certain regimes in certain countries, but that will spread much more and be much more difficult for so many people to live in dignity if we don't control the environmental changes that we're facing right now. So they're one and the same.
To be specific, let's concentrate on Egypt since it's the host of COP27. What is the situation, you would say, about human rights?
Well, I believe there is no concept of human rights nor of environmental rights in the mind of the Egyptian government. So I will comment first and say that the whole idea of holding COP27 in Egypt and Egypt volunteering or putting its name forward to host it is a an idea that came because they want to improve the image of the country. They have no positive environmental record in any way. They have never shown that they care about the environment as a government. So it was very strange that they put their name forward. And the reason is clear. Number one, to cover for their...
Before we go to the reasons, can you give us some examples of cases where you think environmental has not been respected or taken into consideration?
Well, on the books in Egypt, there are laws that prohibit building on agricultural lands, for example. That's not obeyed at all. The agricultural land keeps getting smaller and smaller. The green spaces if they exist, when they exist, which are becoming rarer and rarer in cities, are taken over for building overpasses and bridges and highways. There is no the mass development of the new capital, as they call it, does not have any solid environmental aspect to it, and this is something that's draining the economy of the country. So the latest example was deporting people from a reasonable sized island in the Nile, close to Cairo,
Al Warraq Island,
to build entertainment parks in it, and that is a green island mostly, although it has a considerable number of residents. So no, there is no concept of protecting the environment or building or fighting environment climate change in Egypt at all.
So you think El-Sisi just attracted this COP27 to improve his image or to gain popularity among important countries?
Three reasons, in my opinion. Number one reason is to reestablish Egypt's lost
status
in the region in particular, and in the developing countries as a whole. Egypt has no recognition anymore. Number two is to please the countries that really put environment at their priority or as a sort of priority. And number three, to cover up on the dismal record that Egypt has regarding human rights in general, regarding people's rights, to cover the fact that there are tens of thousands, people say 60,000 minimum, some others say it's up to 100,000 political prisoners and prisoners of opinion in the country. Many of them are not even being persecuted for any particular crime. So those are his reasons. That's the strategy he's going with. It's like exactly buying arms from certain countries to have them stay quiet about his record and not talk. So he's bribing them, basically, or building a nuclear power station, Russian provided or Russian bought from Russia and built by Russia again. To he's paying his way through becoming or remaining as a credible leadership.
And all this is with the money of the people in the country, whereas he is running a very large debt now. And we don't know how he's going to pay the interest on those debts. But leaving the economy aside, I want to pursue the question of human rights and the prisoners' rights. As we have seen, there is one in particular I would like you to comment about. It's the case of Ali Abdel Fattah, since his sister came from Britain to Egypt and held a very popular conference. It was attended by so many journalists. So we would like you to give us some idea about the background, what happened to Ale.
First, Ala Abdel Fattah is an upper middle class Egyptian young man, or at least he was a young man in the early 2000s when he started becoming a blogger, and when the revolution in 2011 erupted, he was writing heavily.
This was the period of the Arab Spring, and he took a leading role in writing.
He took a considerable role. Yes. And he's also, I mean, many people don't know, but his father was a very prominent human rights lawyer that lived in the way he put his money where his mouth is. He was a talented lawyer who had a very modest office, because most of the cases he was taking were human rights cases and workers' cases and the likes. And his mother, a university professor, who also participated in all the political activities done by the few university academics who stood against the regime and called on the regime many times. So he comes from that kind of family. He was a computer programmer. He really decided that he's going to take the same line, obviously, and he's paying the price for it. So he has been in and out of jail through the last 10 years on flimsy charges, on charges that should not exist. I mean, laws that should not exist in the first place. And he's been in prison for the largest part of the last 10 years
under LCC regime. So since 2013, essentially.
And when his dual nationality became known, and now they talk about him as a dual citizen, a British Egyptian, that also brought him more prominence and more responsibility on the West, quote unquote, to fight for him. So his name is now a symbol more than a person. And he very courageously, while in jail, has not given in and has gone on hunger strike for a couple of months now. And in the last 7-8 days since the COP27 started, he went also on water strike. So he was in the risk of dying. The latest news in the last 24-48 hours say that he is drinking water again now.
Yeah, we're bringing the case of Alaa Abdel Fattah precisely because once he took British citizenship through his mother's citizenship, and she is living in the UK, then he became important. And this begs the question, if you are Egyptian, you have no rights. But if you are lucky to have a Western passport, then governments speak for you.
Unfortunately, true, it improves your chances quite a lot in front of the Egyptian injustice system.
And this is, I think, is a tragedy in itself because human rights should be for everyone, not only for a few that are protected by quote-unquote democratic countries or countries of the West.
I'm going to give an example from personal experience. When I was much younger and I lived in Egypt and I used to travel to work in other places, I said to myself, it's so unfortunate to be Egyptian because in the airports, when you're going into other richer countries or European countries with the Egyptian passport, you're second class. When you are coming to Egypt with your own Egyptian passport, you're second class compared to the foreigners. So it's a lose-lose situation, and it's very true. The Egyptian person, and this is the core of the problem, has no dignity and rights in his own land.
Now, of course, Egyptians know that, they're sensitive to that, and there has been a call for a kind of, I would say, protest against the LCC government on November 11. But November 11, we've seen that the streets were empty, Egyptians didn't move from their, I wouldn't say comfort zone, but from their homes. Your comments?
You can spread fear very easily. And if Sisi has managed to do something, he has spread fear among the population by the examples that we have given already, by the large number of those detained, the mass executions that happened, the mass rulings of capital punishment that took place in courts, and all that, excluding the extrajudicial persecutions and
disappearances.
And disappearances. So people are afraid, and when they see that there is no hope, there is no structure, it becomes much more difficult for people to risk themselves. In addition to on November 11th itself, we hear reports about from the night before army or security forces spread in the streets, occupying squares. And also the funny thing is that the Cairo transport system decided to put all its buses into maintenance that day to cripple the city and people can't move. So I'm not surprised.
I will add also another aspect, Ihab. The government is afraid of its own people because we have seen this show of massive army and police in the state, in the streets and in the squares. But also, the people are afraid and the government is afraid. You see immediately that there is a disconnect between both. So, and I think Sisi understands this very well. It's a dangerous situation for him.
of course, it is dangerous, especially while the eyes of Egypt, the eyes of the world are focused on Egypt because of COP27. And that's the last thing he can afford. But I want to say, I want to close with one thing, if I may, which is that Sisi, the Egyptian government, put their bets on COP27 that it's going to improve their image. I am so happy that at the end of the day, living here abroad, looking at Western media, that the Egyptian human rights dismal record has been exposed in the last 10 days much, much more than it was exposed over the past 10 years.
Thank you very much, Ihab. As this is all the time that we have for this interview, we hope to have you again to follow up on the case of the prisoners in Egypt and the human rights abuses record of El-Sisi, and also on the case of Ala Abdel Fattah. I thought that he would be released in 24 hours, but unfortunately, up till now, we don't have any news. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Wraps it up for us here on Amandla yet again this week. Big thank you to Sama for her piece. We will be back next week with a curated show by Feroz Manji of Daraja Press. We are looking forward to that, but stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium. Thank you.